ora, and welcome back to System Fix, a podcast from the health media. My name is Barbara Fountain, and I'm editor of New Zealand Doctor, Rata Aotearoa. System Fix takes a look at progress with the health sector restructuring proposed by the Simpson Report. Each episode, I catch up on events and take a look at different aspects of the change. This episode is being recorded on 14th of March. Thanks for tuning in. Episode of System Fix, we are going to delve into the issue of professional capture of reforms, specifically capture by the medical profession. In the interests of being forward-looking, my guests today are two doctors who have not been intimately involved in previous sector reforms, but do have an interest in leadership and change to improve health outcomes. Vanessa Wienick is a Christchurch GP and chair of the NZMA GP Council. Kia ora, Vanessa.
Kia ora.
George Laking is an Auckland medical oncologist, Aotearoa New Zealand president of the Royal Australasian College of Physicians, and a former chair of Te Ora, the Māori Medical Practitioners Association. Kia ora, George.
Tēnā koe.
Now, while you both have leadership roles, I'd point out that you're speaking in your personal capacity and not as representatives of those various organisations. I'm going to first start by reassuring all the other health professionals out there that I'm not ignoring their role in either our health system or reforms. But whenever big changes have occurred in our system, it is often the doctor's lobby that has been held up as being problematic one way or the other. With that in mind, and again, looking forward, guys, I'm keen to hear your thoughts on how the medical profession is ideally engaged in sector reform. Here's a recap of what has been happening since our last episode. Back in January, in an interview with New Zealand Doctor reporter Martin Johnson, Health Minister Andrew Little said that by the start of February, we would see government engagement with the public over the details of the reforms, including speaking to a range of stakeholders. Well, there has definitely been discussions with stakeholders in the sector, but no public-facing chat about the reform. Last week, the minister formally responded to Martin's questions about this expected engagement with a written statement essentially saying the public engagement took place with the health and disability system review process. And, quote, once the structural decisions are made, there will be extensive engagement over the many parts of the health system, end of quote. The minister also pointed out that when those structures are settled on, the legislative process ensuing would require public submissions. To again quote Mr. Little, so far, we are on track with our decision-making timetable. I expect announcements in April, end of quotes. At the same time last week, Mr. Little wrote to Y2575 claimants with regard to proposed Māori Health Authority, saying the transition unit in the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet will report back to the ministerial group on the initial policy and design work in, quote, the next few months, end of quote. Next few months has a slightly different feel to in April. So to summarise, it's still a case of wait and see. Vanessa, in your role with the General Practice Leaders Forum, do you have any further insights into where things are going with health reforms at the moment?
Apparently there's going to be a cabinet paper at the end of March, and then at least three other sub-papers come out throughout the year. They're expecting that if the initial cabinet paper, which sort of sets out the high-level structural things and lays out what legislation will be needed, that they'll then work through putting some legislation before the House in sort of July this year, and expecting that to then pass by March through all of the select committees and various aspects of it, sort of March next year, and be implemented before the end of 2022. That's the timeline that they're working through in the transition unit. It's not tier one first, because they realise it's a harder thing to do.
And here's my point about this engagement, is none of this is said publicly.
No, and it is all literally. You have to sign out the physical paper. You have to be in the building. You're not allowed past the door. You have to sign a non-disclosure agreement and go and see the paper before it goes to cabinet. So there's no transparency at all. And then afterwards, it's kind of like a fait accompli, isn't it? Once they've done their bit, that's it. They're not going to employ more consultants for longer. Well, at least hopefully they're not. It's kind of get what you're given, really, isn't it?
Mm. Vanessa, if Mrs. Simpson had come to you and said, OK, we really want the medical profession on board, what are your ideas for making that happen?
Well, I think when it comes to general practitioners, the first really good step would have been to actually engage us along the way. it was not very widely discussed with GPs. Some of the leadership groups may have been approached, but there certainly was never any invitations for sort of like town halls or any of that sort of approach for GPs. And even at the PHO level, it was very brief kind of run through meeting with PHO staff. So I don't really feel like the primary care sector was particularly well involved in the discussions in the first instance. And when you read the reports, there's not very many mentions of general practice. I think that would have been the good first step. In terms of getting people on board, it's helpful to understand what it is that drives them. And I don't feel that Heather Simpson necessarily understood the drivers for general practice. And so if you don't understand what is inspiring people and driving them to work, then you're not going to be able to influence them for change.
Do you think if we had set up these town hall meetings that the GPs would have come along?
Absolutely. Yeah, I do. I think they would have really appreciated those opportunities. There's been a lot of apprehension and concern about having change done to people. And being able to participate and to feel like they're heard, I think would have really been appreciated.
George, do you have any thoughts on engaging with specialist colleagues in sector reform?
Oh, kia ora, Barbara. I always like to take a step back and look at what's happening now on an even longer timeline of history in relation to earlier statements using that term professional capture. I think it is of some relevance to doctors because I do believe that over many decades, centuries even, doctors have been accustomed to calling the shots and wielding power in healthcare situations. And I think we have a longer term historical trend of becoming aware as professionals of the power that we wield and actually the responsibility that we have to unload that power and pass it on to the people who are in need of our help. And I think that that was most clearly articulated by Irihapiti Ramsden in her writings about cultural safety, where she really focused on the power that we hold as health professionals and our duty to make that power available to the people that we care about. So just now in the current iteration of healthcare reforms and in previous iterations of healthcare reforms, there's been anxieties even about engaging with the doctors because doctors hold power and pretty much most people who hold power don't want to let it go or give it up. I personally have been very persuaded by Irihapiti Ramsden's writings on cultural safety, which really exhort us to recognise the power that we carry and our duty to make it available to the disempowered.
It's a really personal thing, isn't it, that you come to that realisation and actually being able to spread that understanding amongst colleagues in terms of letting go of some of the power is quite a challenge, I would say. Is that something you've all been involved in addressing maybe in your role with the physicians?
And addressing it at more of a, maybe even like a microscopic level of the professional values that we bring and how we work. And so once we reform the values that we take into our work, then that translates into how we approach healthcare reform.
With the recent changes Pat Sneddon was working through with the ADHB last year, you've been involved with those changes that were aiming to improve health outcomes for Māori, and particularly in the area of surgery. Can you tell us a little bit more about how the process you went through to make that happen and how you engaged colleagues in that?
Yeah. I guess I got to say again, of course, that I'm speaking in my own capacity, although I am an employee of the Auckland District Health Board. So the District Health Board has revitalised its strategy and strategic values to put Te Tiriti o Waitangi and health equity right at the top. And so that strategic thinking gives us the baseline for how we operationalise that and what we do. I think values of equity, another word for that is justice. And I think that justice is a value that's felt strongly by all human beings if we can only perceive it. And once people perceive injustice, they'll work to correct it. And that's something we all share as humans. The challenge is to make injustice visible to people. And I think that comes down to how we tell the stories about how the country's set up that we live in, how the situation that we find ourselves got to be that way, actually how we even start to recognise the situation we find ourselves in. For example, the enduring seven-year shortfall in life expectancy for Māori compared to non-Māori is not something that has been on all clinicians' mind all of the time. But really, when you take heed of that, I think that the basic human reaction of anyone would be to say, hey, look, drop everything. We got to fix this. There's a seven-year difference in life expectancy here. Here's some meaning and purpose for us in our work to fix this injustice.
Another one, George, is the 2.5 times the infant mortality rate for Māori compared to non-Māori. And that is a really shocking one to me as well, because something like that, I think, isn't a statistic that we talk about a lot. I think more and more people are becoming aware of the seven-year gap, and also that gap where the most wealthy Māori male has on statistically a lower life expectancy than the poorest white woman. And so that kind of injustice, like you say, really should spur some action. And the more of those statistics that people talk about, the better. And I'm always boring people at dinner parties and things like that about these kind of things. People like us and others who are able to speak about the injustices and point out the statistical facts, that has a little bit of weight when it comes to persuading, I think, any kind of doctor of anything. Talking to them about statistics and numbers is useful. We all like to think of ourselves as being evidence-based. And so the more that we kind of use that language that we've already got as a common denominator, the more that people are able to engage with that on a considered a normal professional level. We're talking about science and we're talking about facts. This is not something that needs to be a motive at all, other than we should be worried about it. But it's not something where it's about your opinion. This is just how it is, and you can't really argue with the facts. And so that, I think, quite persuasive for helping people to make changes.
So if, in fact, professional capture was about professionals capturing the space to ensure these changes took place for patients, as opposed to capturing the space to ensure the privilege that they may have held in the past continued, then professional capture would be a positive.
Absolutely. I think that there may be a little bit of a, I hate to say it, a generational difference. Certainly the way that I was trained at medical school was quite different to a lot of my colleagues. And so there was always, right from the beginning, a focus on equity and justice, and all of those sort of things came into it. And considerations of Māori health were part of sort of every subject that we did. And I guess we were becoming more and more aware of it. And it's only increased since, you know, post-graduation. And those who are even younger than I am, they're trained in even different models, like the Mehana model, and using the, you know, a different approach to consultations based on how the Pōwhiri kind of mihi approach, kaupapa Māori and motaranga Māori approaches, rather than just a Pākehā perspective, I think has been started to be more and more incorporated into medical training. So that's good.
One of the reasons it seems to me that professional capture becomes an issue is because each of the professions has a fear that the other profession is not going to do the job as well as they would. I think that's really strong where managers get involved and health professionals of any type feel that managers, by their nature, are not as intrinsically linked to the outcomes for patients. Mm-hmm. In the Simpson report, it actually talks about trying to change the regulatory processes, although it does say that's quite possibly a little bit difficult, so that there's more flexibility to adjust scopes of practice. And to quote it, says, this creates opportunities to work collaboratively and look beyond traditional professional boundaries to focus on the competencies the community needs and enable flexibility as to who is best placed to meet them. And as soon as we start talking about changing scopes of practice, there's kind of a major, oh no. And I just wonder, in terms of A, at the moment we have the largely private general practice and the public hospital system, which has struggled to work together. and separately have their own issues of professional capture. And then we have the capture between different clinical groups and the distrust. And then we have the distrust between the managers and the clinicians. Then we have the distrust between the managers and the politicians. But if we go back to the key point that both of you have raised, is that if as individuals, everyone inherently understands where our system has failed and where it can do better and is committed to making that happen, that potentially overrides a lot of these problems, don't you think? George?
Yeah, so with capture, really what it is at its base is a power struggle. And it's not at all surprising. We've got a great big enterprise called the health system that has the noble purpose of increasing the health of all people in the country. And we've got a whole lot of highly skilled, experienced people inside that who have their own ideas about what direction it should go in. And it's no surprise that there may be a bit of competition to set the direction of the healthcare system, and in some ways a power struggle. I think what's really desirable is if we can find a way to diffuse that sort of language of power struggle and capture and competition, and bring the focus back to the actual job that needs to be done and the values that we share in doing it. That way we realise we've got a lot more in common than what you might think just from our professional silos. And so in relation to that, I personally feel quite comfortable about the idea of increasing scope of practice for the different professions that we have. You know, I got to admit here, I see the part of the health system that I inhabit. So other people may see things differently. But I have a hypothesis, I guess I got to say, in relation to phenomena of burnout experienced by many of us. And I do see a connection. I'm not saying this is the complete explanation for burnout, but I do see a connection with the way in which we've tended to guard our professional roles to the point where we find the demands on us now exceed our capacity and capability as a workforce. And so I have come to feel very comfortable with the idea of sharing the load around, because I feel confident that that's not going to make us professionally irrelevant. We have got things to offer and we'll still be able to offer those things, but I'm quite open to sharing the workload around.
It's interesting that George should mention burnout just the same week that the College of GPs released their findings in a recent survey on burnout, which showed very high rates of burnout amongst GPs. And I think many GPs have expressed concerns and worries about pharmacists or nurse practitioners and various other groups taking over roles and tasks that were general practice driven. But to be honest, I think now there's so many people retiring and so much work has been pushed out from hospitals that we're not hard up for a job. We're looking around and trying as much as we can, most of us, to find other people to help us with it. So I think actually when it comes to scopes of practice and roles, one of the fears that GPs have is that they maintain responsibility despite the fact that other people are doing the work. And I think if we could address that, it may actually unburden some of the concerns that people have, because we are vicariously responsible for everything that goes on in the hospital, let alone anything that goes on in the community with people who are in different roles. So I think GPs are probably the group most targeted by health and disability kind of issues. And so potentially, if there was some way of maybe reducing liability when other professional groups are working with patients and making it so that the GP wasn't the default person responsible always, I think would help a lot.
Nodding in agreement there, George.
Yeah, kia ora, Vanessa.
That may be the point that is in the Simpson report where they're talking about workforce reform and the reform to the Health Practitioners Competence Assurance Act about who actually has responsibility or how those responsibilities have shared. George, you mentioned earlier on the words of professional capture. When I was thinking about this, I was trying not to use the words professional capture. And actually, you reminded me of something that Gabrielle Baker, who's one of our regular panelists, has talked about, and that is power, about so much of what we talk about here, the underlying issue is power. In some ways, I think, Vanessa, as you were saying, with the actual review, the fact that there was a reluctance to maybe engage with some sectors directly was that concern that the doctor groups would try to take some kind of control of the review process, not quite sure how. Presumably that was one of the underlying concerns. Also, the concern being then if they did that, that other groups may not come forward.
It's interesting that, yes, there are power dynamics, and definitely when it comes to clinical relationships, those power dynamics are something that George mentioned that we need to be very careful about. When it comes to kind of engagement in the health sector and reforms and things like that, I actually don't see doctors as being particularly any more powerful than any other group. And I think that's because of that historical place that people have viewed doctors as. And so there is quite a broad attempt to reduce that impact. And I think that's been effective. So I don't think that there's an imbalance. And possibly it goes a little bit too far. I guess that's probably showing my bias. But I feel that, you know, when I look at when the pandemic struck last year, trying to get things done differently in the hospital compared to, you know, primary care. My husband, who's also a medical oncologist, trying to get plastic chairs put in the waiting room so that they could wipe them down. He wasn't even able to organise that. And, you know, meanwhile, we completely reorientated the way that we did our business because we are the ones who actually own the businesses and have the authority to do that. Whereas if you're the clinical director of a department in a hospital, at least in my DHB, there's generally no actual authority to make any decisions regarding budgetary expenditure and that sort of thing. So people are actually quite disempowered and decision making is actually quite difficult. It becomes about trying to influence people rather than actually having any direct authority to actually make anything happen. So, yeah, I think that there's a perception of power that I think is not necessarily a reality.
So going forward, maybe March, April or May, regarding the structures of the new system, George, how would you like to see you and your colleagues being engaged in decisions or responses to that? Because apparently there is going to be more public engagement after those structures come out.
Yeah, it seems like quite an enormous task, Barbara. And coming back to these anxieties about how much power each group has, I think we could diffuse a whole lot of that to the extent that we're able to work as teams across disciplines, united by shared values, and get along with each other and demonstrate that we work in that way. A doctor that stands up alongside a nurse and a nurse that stands up alongside a doctor, just by that very act, do a whole lot to diffuse and dispel many of these historical prior assumptions about power and power struggles. And so from my own experience, I find myself looking at Māori ways of working and what tikanga can bring. In my experience, the Māori organisations that I've worked with have been quite a bit further down the road in terms of getting cohesive, unified approach of the organisation that transcends some of those boundaries defined by professional role. So I've been an advocate for changing the way that we work inside our own organisation so that it's a more Māori way of working.
Because one of the comments that the minister has made, and I think it also came out in the Simpson report, was that the structural changes are really the baby steps. The big steps are the cultural, the change of the culture of our health system. And that's kind of what both you guys have been talking about is that it's that change to teams, the getting rid of the perceived power imbalance across the different clinical groups. And that is a huge change. I'm really intrigued as to how we do that. I mean, I know it's possible because, as you both mentioned there, we have seen organisations who have changed their models of care, changed the way they work with each other. In primary care, we do see nurse practitioners, practice nurses, healthcare assistants, a whole number of groups now kind of working to the top of their scopes.
Barbara, we've talked about awareness of the scale of unmet health need and inequitably distributed health need. And then there's two other words that you can put alongside that, which is knowledge and skills, the knowledge and skills to remedy that awareness. And it just brings me back to Vanessa's observation about the education that we've had and the change in the content of education as we've gone through the years. So that, in fact, what I've concluded is those of us who were educated earlier, we actually missed out on an up-to-date education. And it can sound pretty harsh to say, but I believe that basically probably most of us are in need of some remedial adult education so that we can do our job right, which is quite a strange realisation to come to, given that as a workforce, we generally regard ourselves as highly educated and highly skilled, but in critical areas of being able to make health work for all the people under our care, we fall short. And one of the first remedies for that is further education.
I totally agree with you there, George. I did a postgrad diploma in public health, and one of the first papers was a Foundations of Whole Water Māori paper, which has some fantastic content and just history that was never included in any of my education going up to that point. And it was just a real eye-opener. I think I've spoken to Barbara about this before. And I think the more people that do those sorts of postgraduate education opportunities, the better. Totally agree.
That was actually something I had down here to raise with you, Vanessa, because when we did speak about that, you mentioned how that education made you rethink how you were working with some of your patients, and particularly with the appointments. And I just wondered how that was going. You moved away from being very, very time focused and giving a bit more flexibility.
Yeah, I think it just made me be more relaxed. And so if people turn up late, especially Māori patients, then I fit them in. Whereas before I was kind of a hard ass. I just say, no, you have to come back. And I've just got more of an appreciation about the time and that other people don't see it the same. You know, that when I was saying before, you've got to understand where people's values come from, and understanding your own as well is important. And also realizing that just because something's held dear to you doesn't mean that other people see it as such an important thing. And that's okay. So, yeah, it was quite a big change for me to be more relaxed about time. That doesn't mean that I'm not still running on time, mostly, but it's been a big insight. And another insight for me that, you know, that runs across some of the governance work that I do and things as well is the idea that interaction should be mana enhancing. And so whenever I'm thinking about criticizing someone, or if I do criticize someone, I often, if I'm telling myself off later, it's because it wasn't necessarily mana enhancing and didn't necessarily need to be said. And so I try to improve the way that I can say it can be a little bit more gentle and mana enhancing.
Well, that's great. Hey, George, so that's a really good point you've made about continuing education at a really high level. You guys have talked about younger folk coming up through are getting a much more enhanced education than what we had about things that are relevant today.
You know, the Medical Council is telling us to move in this direction to be fit for purpose for the 21st century. I got to say, young people are learning the skills it's needed to do the job today. It's a little bit tragic that they're learning the skills that also were needed to do the job 10, 20, 30 years ago, finally learning it now. Cultural safety has been missing for decades. The comment about education related to changing the culture of how we work, and I can educating people for change is a beautiful way to change a culture when it works well and people are engaged in education and feel positive about it and feel empowered in working in a new way. I just got to add for comparison, one of the other ways of changing culture is simply to wait until the people who carried the previous version of culture are no longer in the workplace and retire. But that's not really mana enhancing, and we don't have that amount of time to wait. I got one anecdote, which make of it what you will, but it's just a memory from the first reforms of the 1990s, because I grew up in Wellington and I studied at Wellington School of Medicine at the end of the 80s and start of the 90s. And then I went away for a year, and when I came back in 1993, they had become a Crown Health enterprise, and that was my first year working as a doctor. And I went upstairs, it must have been for some HR-related topic, to the executive suite, and there was freshly squeezed orange juice and cut flowers on the sideboard. And I said something to the person there about looking for someone for some documentation, and they said, "Oh, are you new here?" And I said, "No, you are." It was just me being a bolshy first year junior doctor. But anyhow, Crown Health Enterprises are a thing of the past now.
Oh, yeah, they are. Cash registers in the foyer, all gone. So the System Fix pop quiz, in which I ask you a question or two regarding the Simpson report to see if you've read it.
And
honestly, I, in terms of today's topic, I did actually scroll through and I couldn't find anything directly about capture by professions. And I did look back at the interim report and I couldn't find anything specifically in there either. So my question, how many times does the word doctor appear in the final report of the Health and Disability System Review Panel?
This is my choice, or is it guess the way to the Christmas cake?
Guess the way to the Christmas cake. Sorry, how many times?
220.
Three.
Oh, you're very close, Vanessa. Twice. It's twice in the main report, and twice in one of the references had the word doctor in it. So, in fact, the word doctor appears twice in the final report. And the word medical practitioner, how many times?
Oh, maybe three.
Well, actually, twice. And in this case, one of those times was thanks to the Māori Medical Practitioners Association. So in fact, the term medical practitioner appeared only once in the report. In the interim report, how many times did the word doctor appear in the interim report of the Health and Disability System Review Panel?
None. Never.
Oh dear. This is a slippery slope. No, actually it appeared 34 times in the interim report. So what you have to think about is, where did we go from 34 times down to twice? It may just be a matter of good sub-editing, something I'm very keen on myself. But, yeah, words speak volumes.
Especially the ones you don't say.
Yes. I'm sure someone out there is going to email me and say, actually, did you not count this? But no, this was my, you know, word search. Well, kia ora, guys. Thank you so much for taking part today. It was a bit of a wide-ranging discussion over a slightly ephemeral subject, and I really, really appreciate your time. Kia ora.
Ta-da.
Ta-da.
Thanks for listening to System Fix, brought to you by The Health Media. If you're interested in finding out more about changes to the health system, you can subscribe to New Zealand Doctor Rāte Aotearoa by going to nzdoctor.co.nz, or you could also subscribe to Pharmacy Today. Go to pharmacytoday.co.nz. The Health Media also produces The Roster, Te Rārangi, a regular email newsletter providing news of people moving around the health system. Thanks again, kia ora. I look forward to catching up with you next time.